This is Probabilities. I'm Richard Walensky with my co-host, Richard A. Lupoff. Our guest is Sue Grafton, author of the Kinsey Millhone Mysteries, the most recent of which is I is for Innocent. Others include H is for Homicide and G is for Gumshoe. At the end of H is for Homicide and the beginning of I is for Innocent, Kinsey Millhone, after a number of books, has been dumped by California Fidelity. What's going on? What are you doing?
Well, it was a surprise to me, as it was a surprise to her. I got to the end of the book, and the guy fired her. And what was I to do? She had to go get a job doing something. Part of it is a chance to explore something new. I thought it was a new venue for her, and it makes it sort of entertaining for me. Also, I have been fired in my day, and I know what kind of trauma that can be. So it was fun to get out some of my own stuff on the subject.
Dick Lupoff.
In fact, there are a number of changes that have been going on in the past couple of books. I think Kinsey finally got rid of her VW bug and got a new car.
Well, it's another VW. She was driving a 68 beige with assorted dings and dents. Now she has my 74 bug with just one tiny ding in the left rear fender. So the car she was driving was one I owned some years ago. Now she's got my actual car.
And a book or two ago, I believe she was burned out and got a new apartment.
Yes, there was a terrible bomb that went off, and so now everybody's very crazy about her new apartment. They just love that.
Well, as I read about it, I recalled it would have been a very, very nice place for a single person to live. Have you been getting interested in architecture of late?
To some extent. What I like about architecture is that it is something you can describe. When I did I is for Innocent and I needed an occupation for the character Isabel Barney, I went through a number of considerations, and it seemed to me that to talk about painting or music, you have to take the word of the other characters that somebody is wonderful at what they do. But there's something about architecture that I think lends itself to images, and it seemed to me a much more concrete occupation for her. So I had also found some articles in the LA Times that were useful to me. So who knows? You know how it is. When you write, you just invent these things on the spot, and then you're stuck.
Well, sometimes God puts funny things in your brain, and
yes.
You say, well, why are you doing this?
Yes, please, leave me alone here.
There are a couple of other things that have been occurring in the past few books. Mm-hmm. Those of us who've been with you from the beginning of the universe notice them, of course. One is, it seems to me that Kinsey has been going through some changes in her self-image and her relationship with the world around her.
What's interesting to me is, see, I can't see her as you see her, because I write from the inside out. So I almost ought to turn the question on you and have you tell me how you see the change in her. From my perspective, I know there is a process that is ongoing, but it's hard for me to articulate those concrete changes, because from my perspective, I write at such close range that I can't always step back and look at it from your point of view. So how do you see her changing?
Well, let me bounce a couple of notions off
okay.
you then. Do you agree with my perception that she is becoming more confident and more comfortable with herself and her role and her profession?
I think so, except I must say that the feedback I've been getting on I is for Innocent is that she seems chastened. She seems somewhat subdued, and I think because of the fact that she's been fired and she's having to sort of regroup. Now, again, I can't speak to that issue because she and I are the same creature, but it is a projection.
Well, she seems to be aware of that in the book. At one point when she breaks into someone's house, she goes, the good old Kinsey, up to my old tricks again.
Yes, yes.
So it is conscious. It is
yes.
a surface thing.
Yeah, I think there is a kind of sassiness that's been knocked out of her, I hope only temporarily. And we'll have to see what happens to her when we get to book the next.
Well, does that seem to just come from your own internal drive writing it, or is there anything external?
I don't think there is anything external. I have said many times that in some respects I don't control these books, and I don't mean to sound mystical about it, but in some ways my job is to get out of my own way so that the books can come through me. In this respect, too, they're like children, which is just a metaphor I can't stand. However, it's the truth. A book has its own personality. It has its own nature. I can give birth to it, but I can't take total responsibility for its personality. So sometimes it's as big a surprise to me as it is to the reader, the overall character of a book.
But on the other hand, in reading a number of your books, in the most recent, certainly G, more so with H, and even more so with I, the plot, they're more plot-driven than they've ever been before, which means that there seems to be more organization behind them.
Well, now, with G and with H, those two books in some ways were departures. G was a combination of almost like a road picture. It was Kinsey Millhone and Robert Dietz trying to get away from the bad guy. You always knew who the bad guy was. There was no mystery about that. The other story that I told in G is for Gumshoe was about, see, I've already forgotten his name, Patrick, the old lady who's lost
Edna.
In the Mojave Desert. Yeah. See, I mean, I lose it as quickly as you do. And H is for Homicide, again, was not a traditional whodunit. You always knew Raymond Maldonado was the culprit. It was a question of how Kinsey Millhone would help put that case together. So when I got to I is for Innocent, I really wanted to go back around to a very old-fashioned whodunit. And it was great fun for me.
But you also, at the same time, it's so controlled. How do you allow for those little variances when you know the controlling way that you're going along with it?
The control is a curious issue because truly I know the overall story. I haven't the faintest idea what's going to go on from day to day. And I use a method that Tony Hillerman has described in that he says he blocks out about six moves ahead of himself. And I think Elmer Leonard works the same way, perhaps more free form than I. But in effect, it's like driving in fog. You move forward through the fog, and as you move forward, your headlights illuminate the path in front of you. The beauty of having a word processor is that you do always have ultimate control over that beginning, middle, and end. So if you get to chapter 18 and you realize you have erred early on, you can go back and make the whole of it come together as you need it to do.
Does this mean that you work from a detailed outline?
No. It means that I'm flying by the seat of my pants. I keep a journal for each book, and this is like a long letter to myself in which I describe the process of writing a book. So when I get to the end of I is for Innocent, I will have a journal about the writing of that book that will be three times longer than the book itself. I call it my protracted whining. I log in every day and talk about what it feels like to be writing that particular section of a book. I also will lay out all the possibilities for a scene. I lay out motivations. I lay out character biographies. And through that, I begin to piece together the overall structure in addition to the day-to-day details of how the writing is going.
Have you ever considered publishing one of these? It seems to me it would be fascinating for would-be writers, for English lit students at universities.
It's possible. I'm leaving my papers. It sounds so pretentious, but it's true. To Boston University because they ask me, you know. I think when I read back over these journals, they're so tedious and so boring, it would just make you faint. I do think it would give you an insight into my insecurities and that sort of thing. And I suppose from an academic point of view, for a scholar to watch how a book comes together might be moderately interesting, but not very.
Do you ever wake up in the middle of the night and turn on a light and scribble, oh, my God, I should have had her turn left at that juncture instead of right?
I don't wake up and turn the light on and scribble, but certainly in the dead of night, Bright Brain will give me information. And those are all recorded in the journal. Many entries in the journal start last night in the dead of night, RB, Right Brain, told me, Right Brain will remind me that it's raining. This little voice comes, don't forget it's been raining. Or don't forget she's still wearing her all-purpose dress and has to change her clothes. And it's like having a gift laid on my pillow, like a little rose. So I treasure that because those are things that I don't consciously keep track of.
Actually, Kinsey herself has an experience like that in I is for Innocent.
Yes. That is a very difficult moment to describe. I think a lot of our thinking process is by aha. It isn't that you can lay out information and follow it from step A to B to C. Often, information comes in those sudden leaps where you get it. And to convey that in a piece of fiction is very tricky to do, but it has happened to her on other occasions when suddenly she understands how the pieces come together.
Do you sometimes feel that you have to dumb her up or smarten her up?
I hope not. Certainly the conventions of mystery fiction are such that if she figured it out on page two, you would have a very short book. So my job as the writer is to lay the story out so that the process of discovery is such that she only gets it at the end. Obviously, if there were a character in the fifth chapter who came along and said, I know who done it, and I'll tell you who it is, we wouldn't be in business.
In an interview elsewhere, you talk about how while a number of other writers like to focus on more political ideas, you believe in the personal. And yet, in each of your last three books, you do deal with issues. In G, you deal with nursing homes to some degree. In H, with Tourette's syndrome. And in I, with teen alcoholism and dysfunctional families. So you are, in fact...
Well, dysfunctional family is a theme that I thread throughout because I came from one. But when it comes to nursing homes, I don't have a position, except I think they should be clean and well-lighted. You know, it isn't an issue in that I'm trying to uncover any great scandals. It happens that she finds a woman who is in a nursing home. I don't think it's any revelation that some are not as well-run as others. When it comes to Tourette, that was interesting for me because that character, Raymond Maldonado, appeared at my doorstep probably in the dead of night, thanks to Right Brain, with Tourette syndrome. And at that point, I did not know much about this disorder. And I didn't want to write about it. I felt it was very risky. I think it is a very difficult disorder for those who have it. And I didn't want to be in that position because I knew he was the bad guy. So I got in touch with the Tourette Syndrome Association, and I talked to a woman named Muriel Seligman, who's the national publicity director. And fortunately, she knew my work. So in my telephone conversation with her, I said, here's what I'm faced with. I've got a guy with Tourette, and he's the bad guy. And she started laughing. She said, well, why can't people with handicaps have the best part, which is what the villain always is? So I just took my heart in my hand and went about the business of writing this and trying to be as accurate as I could.
Well, at the same time, though, it gives him a personal depth. So by the end of the book, I did not see him as the villain as I would have seen.
No, nor I. I think in many ways what's interesting about villains is they are not the people who drool and squint. They are just like you and me, only slightly more bent than we.
You've been talking about Tourette's syndrome. I'm sure some of our listeners are saying, what in the world is she talking about?
Tourette is a neurological disorder that is connected, they believe, with obsessive compulsive behavior also, which is just a variation of it. It is characterized by ticking or sudden involuntary spasms, and it has many forms. There is a 25% of these people suffer from what they call coprolalia, which is a compulsion to swear. They just swear, and they can't help themselves. Often the ticking will be touching themselves. Maybe they have to go back and turn the stove off 16 times before they leave the house. Sometimes it's a head jerk. You've probably seen people like it without understanding what's going on. It's exhausting. They can control it in certain circumstances, but it's almost like a pressure, as I understand it, builds up. And I developed a great compassion for this through the process of researching the book. And I do feel in Raymond Maldonado's case that as you go through the book, you begin to see the devastation in his life because of this problem he's had from birth.
It is physiological in origin?
Yes, and it's usually affects males, and it usually shows up between the ages of 7 and 10 when boys are in their rowdy phase anyway. So often parents don't understand what's happening. It looks like they're doing things to get attention. It looks like they're misbehaving and being deliberately disobedient. So a father will say, quit that. You know, kid's doing something that he can't help, some little involuntary ticking, and the kid keeps doing it, and they'll get into child abuse over it. It's just very distressing.
Did you decide to devote an entire book virtually to that?
I didn't decide to do it. I decided not to do it, and a character a character will insist. And after a while, I thought, I've got to quit fighting this and just write the book as it comes. So in the end, though it made me uneasy, I felt in order to be truthful in the nature of Raymond Maldonado, I needed to keep this piece of his nature.
Well, you also have something else occurring, both in certainly in G and I, which is characters who seem to be not diseased, but seem to be suffering from a great deal of illness.
And somebody else remarked about that. And I think it is true in I, and I don't know why. This is, you know, people do have heart attacks. People, or maybe I've been seeing a lot of that in my life. I'm not conscious of it. Again, what comes through the books is not always something I can control.
There are actually two women with cancer. One has it, and one has kind of gotten rid of it.
Yeah. Well, again, part of that is because I know a lot of cancer survivors, and I think it isn't right to imply that every case of cancer is a death sentence, especially these days when they are working such miracles.
Dick Lupoff?
Do you think that this is possibly a reflection of the graying of America? The baby boomers are not kids anymore. The general population bulge is moving out toward the greater end.
That's possible. Also, I think illness is a way of talking about people under stress. And I think violence and crime are the same thing. So in some ways, it is all a way of looking at people who are enduring great hardships and trying to cope with the unfathomable, which is illness and murder.
There are a number of characters in your most recent books who are fascinating, and I'd like to ask you some questions about one in particular, a woman in I Is for Innocence, Yolanda.
Ah, Yolanda. I came to that character through a picture in a magazine. I had, for some reason, cut out a picture of this woman, and when I came to the moment in the book that I needed to look at her, I pulled the picture out, and all of her character came through that photograph. I don't know who this woman is in the real world. I think she's some very snooty, philanthropic sort in New York City, but I really don't know who she is. What I liked about Yolanda, and often I like the characters who are cranky and impossible. They are my favorites. You know, you see the dynamic between her and her husband, and you realize that she doesn't understand how hostile she's being toward him. Kinsey suffers with this relationship because she is unwittingly drawn into their quote-unquote banter, and she gets very uncomfortable. I think a lot of Kinsey's view of families is that there is often this very unhealthy chemistry that runs, and she as the outsider is subjected to this dynamic without being really interested in participating.
But Kinsey herself has a sort of pseudo-family relationship with Henry.
Yes. Henry, of course, is her landlord. He is now 84 years old. What I love about Henry, and he is an invented character. He did not come from anybody in my life. But certainly I see him as a vital, healthy person. And it's fun for me to write about somebody in their 80s who is not feeble and not in any way incapacitated. He is a real live wire. And I know that he and Kinsey, in one book she talks about the fact that they view each other across this 50-year age gap with great interest and all with great decorum. I mean, they would never cross any line, but there is an odd sexual attraction between the two of them. And it takes the form of a father-daughter relationship in some ways, but when I wrote F is for Fugitive, I had gotten all the way to the last page of the book before I understood it was a book about fathers. And it was her way of understanding her relationship to Henry. So, again, these are things I didn't consciously set out to do.
I find myself repeatedly seeing a comparison or seeing a parallel and trying to draw the comparison between Kinsey's relationship with Henry and Sarah Paretsky's V.I. Vorshovsky's has a neighbor who is a much older
that's
man
right,
and their
right.
relationship. Have you ever thought about the comparison?
I have looked at that, and I can't remember whether Mr. Contreras, who's the Sarah Paretsky character, was always there. I can't remember if he appeared in the early books. I think V.I. Warshawski's relationship to Mr. Contreras is slightly more antagonistic. Certainly, Kinsey and Henry Pitts get along much better. I have to work to keep it from getting syrupy, because that's not what I'm interested in doing. But most of what I'm doing with Henry Pitts is looking at a man who in theory is geriatric, in that geriatric set, and I just think he's dynamite.
I think one of the differences is that, say, in G, when Kinsey has to take in a detective to protect her, she asks Henry for help, and he's willing to give it. I think Mr. Contreras would have freaked under similar circumstances. So I think there is a very definite difference in how they respond.
Yeah.
Do you think that Henry might have been a little jealous of Dietz?
Oh, I think so. I think so. Again, a difficult issue just in terms of Kinsey's character, was the whole issue of would she hire somebody to protect her in G is for Gumshoe. And I finally thought to myself, this is not a political statement. If my life were in jeopardy and I was on somebody's hit list, I would not screen applicants according to gender. I would hire the most capable person I could find, and the bigger the better. You know, I would want a guy with a great big gun. And so that's what she finds. And yet many people took issue with that, feeling that she should have done it herself. And I think, oh, don't be crazy. You know, when my house gets broken into, I call the police. And I don't care what sex they are when they get there. I want them to be competent.
Do you feel that people are trying to make you into a political spokesperson?
I suspect there is some inclination to interpret me in political terms, and that's fine. I don't set about making political statements because I'm trying to tell good stories, and I'm never interested in distorting a storyline or altering a character to hit political marks. I am not interested in being politically correct. I think the truth is very untidy, and that's what interests me more. I don't think the world lines up properly, and thank God for that. So in telling these stories, I am not interested in politics. I keep saying politicians are the biggest fiction writers in this country. I wish they would get off my turf. You know, I'm trying to tell stories. At least I'm honest about the fact that I'm making it up. They're out there promoting this stuff that's no more true than what I say, and I think I'm doing a better job of it.
You've been writing these Kinsey Millhone books. You're up to the ninth now. What was the year of the first one?
In 1982.
82.
So. But there was a gap between A and B because I had writer's block.
You've taken this series, which started, I believe it had a relatively modest reception at the beginning, and it has built into one of the very, very successful literary phenomena of the day. If you have any particular comment on that or any notion as to why.
I haven't a clue. And again, you see, this is a sort of meta question, and it asked me to step outside myself and comment on something I'm not qualified to comment on, in that I don't know how Kinsey Millhone is perceived, and I don't know what the reading public is experiencing in that suddenly women writers are hot. Often interviewers ask that, and I go, I'm clueless, man. I'm happy it's happening, but I don't know why. I think certainly we live in a society where women are beginning to do more things. There are women private investigators. There are women police. There are women judges and women attorneys. So I think it is time to start looking at that in fiction, and maybe that's part of what it's about. I think if I can judge from the letters I get, people feel an affinity with this woman private investigator because she's irreverent, and she's sassy, and she is independent. She has a smutty mouth, and that's fun. I hope that's what it's about.
Do you read the books of these other women writers like Sarah Paretsky or Nancy Picard or Marcia Muller?
Well, we live in a very small community, the mystery writers. We all know each other, and when we see each other at BoucherCon, which is the mystery convention, or at the Edgars, it's nice to be able to say, I just read your last book. Now, I'm always hopelessly behind. You know, the stack of books by my bed is growing faster than my reading ability, but certainly I keep up with them, and I read all the guys, too, because there are a lot of guys who've been working in this field for a long time.
Do you notice, as you become more successful, any kind of gap that separates you from the others, or is that sort of beyond them in the outside world?
Oh, one tries to minimize that because I have said for years, I don't think writing has anything to do with gender. I don't think it has anything to do with how much money you're being paid. I think it is a very difficult form, the mystery novel. And I see us as in it together. So I figure everybody's problems are the same. What the hell are you going to do on the next page? You know, that's the issue we face. And in that, I see us as connected. But I'm the Lone Ranger. I'm the only one out there saying that, so maybe it's not true.
Well, I have just one question remaining, and that is, what happens to Kinsey Millhone on the next page? In a much broader sense, is she going to age? Is she going to evolve in her relationships and so forth? Or are these books, I hope you won't consider this derogatory, but are you planning to stamp them out more or less cookie cutter fashion?
Oh, never, never, never. I don't know where she is going. She will age 1 year for every 2.5 books. Sometimes you'll be there on her birthday and sometimes you won't. But certainly she will evolve, and I don't know. I think she will evolve at the same rate I do. I'm trying very hard to make each book different without being straining for the effect. I am not interested in writing A is for Alibi 26 times. I would be bored senseless. The challenge is that I have called my shots up front. You know, I have announced I am doing the alphabet. Yes, folks, I am. A, B, C. And it took people till about D to get it. And I still have people going, are you doing the alphabet? I'm going, yes, I am. And they say to me, are you really going to Z? And I think, no, I'm going to quit in the middle and wreck your bookshelf. But I am going to Z is for Zero. And the challenge is, can she do it?
What year would that be?
The year 2008. Please stay healthy. I want everybody with me.
Two questions about that. What is the next one? J is for?
I can't tell you because, A, I have no title, and, B, they are running a contest through the American Booksellers Association. So the bookseller who guesses the title of J gets to have me for a book signing. So it will either be somebody I've signed for before, I'll be in Toehold, Montana, or someplace quite strange.
What about X?
X is for xenophobe, because you can't be X is for xylophone. That would be a strange mystery novel indeed.
We're pretty much out of time, but I wanted to ask you about Kinsey Millhone's all-purpose black dress. Does it exist?
Oh, yes. I own it. I bought it actually in Columbus, Ohio in about 1979, and I paid $98 for it, which was the most I had ever paid for a dress. It is just a remarkable garment, but it is largely polyester, and my children have made me promise never to wear it again. But I keep swearing I'm going to take it with me on my tour and at least hold it up to the public eye so we can all see what this amazing dress looks like.
Is it shiny?
Slightly. And truly, you can wrinkle it in your hand and let go, and it springs right back. It's remarkable.
Well, before we leave, what other weird little things of Kinsey's are also yours?
Oh, well, I do, as we talked about earlier, I do own the VW that she's currently driving. She is not on my insurance. I own two of the handguns. I own the little .32 caliber Colt she had originally, and I own the Davis, but I kept getting letters from gun experts, largely male, who assured me this was not the proper gun for her at all. So in H, she gets a new one, or G, I guess the end of G, and you don't see it again until I is for innocent. We have many, many of those issues in common, not all of which I'm willing to tell in public.
Do you eat the way she eats?
No, she gets to eat worse than I do. She will never gain weight, so she can eat junk food. I've had to give up all kinds of fat, sea, and salt. That's no fun at all, but I let her eat what she wants to. She will probably never marry again in the course of these books, and I doubt she will have children, although I'm intending to give her Z is for Zero. She may do anything she pleases, and it may not even be a mystery. It just may be the grand finale of Kinsey Millhone.
We've been talking on probabilities with author Sue Grafton, who has a long way to go to get to Z is for Zero. I is for Innocent is the latest. H is for Homicide. G is for Gumshoe. And I guess most of the others are available in paperback now. I'm Richard Walensky with Richard A. Lupoff on Probabilities.